Happy Friday, everyone, and welcome to the History of Things podcast. I'll be your host, Mark, and today I thought we would go over the history of embalming. I do have a bit of experience in the funeral business myself, and so I thought it'd be kind of neat to explore where embalming originally came from and how it's done today in comparison to back when it started. So grab yourself a cold beverage, get yourself a comfy seat by the fire, and we'll be right back with the show. So, not surprisingly, embalming seems to have started with the Egyptians. During the year 6000 BC to 600 AD, an estimated 400 million bodies were mummified. It was said by a Greek historian named Herodotus that the Egyptians were the first to believe in the soul having immortality, believing that the soul would never forsake the body if the body remained intact. Embalming or mummification would allow this to happen. They believed that the soul would return to the body after its cycle of necessity. So this cycle of necessity is supposedly a 3,000-year journey that the soul needs to complete before returning to its body, after which the whole man would arise from the dead and live with the gods. Another reason for embalming was for sanitation purposes. The Egyptians also noticed that the unsanitary conditions would lead to more deaths. So based on the wealth of the individual, the Egyptians practiced three methods of embalming. So the most expensive package basically was comprised of five steps. Step number one was removal of the brain, and then the skull was packed with resin. Step number two was evisceration, which basically meant the organs were removed, and then the organs were washed and mixed with resins and spices, and either returned back to the body or placed in a burial vase, which was called canopic jars, C-A-N-O-P-I-C, jars. And then step number three was immersion. Their bodies were immersed in natron, N-A-T-R-O-N, which was basically a sodium salt. And this solution was quite caustic, that the fingers and toenails would actually be removed. The nails would be replaced because, as I said earlier, they believed the body would be needed again in 3,000 years. The immersion itself could last anywhere from 20 to 70 days. And then step number four was dehydration. The body was cleansed, straightened up, and dried out in the sun. And number five was wrapping. So the body would be wrapped in approximately 1,200 yards of 3 1/4 inch bandage. Gum or glue was used to tie the cloth together, and the body was then placed into a sarcophagus, then given back to the family. The least expensive package was basically consisted of just the immersion into that natron fluid, and the package in between was just a bit of combination of both. And it looks like the Egyptians weren't the only ones that were practicing this type of preservation. There were ancient Ethiopian tribes that preserved their decedents in a similar way to the Egyptians. Around 900 BC, Aboriginal inhabitants of the Canary Islands mummified their dead as well. Others like Persians, Babylonians, and Syrians figured out how to deprive the bacteria in the body from oxygen by submersing the bodies in either honey or wax, which would prevent decomposition. So in the 16th century, basically 1,000 years before being conquered by Spain, the Peruvians practiced mummification. The Greeks were a little different. They believed that the decedent must make a journey across the river Styx to the land of eternity. Styx was spelt the same way as the band. The decedent would have to have a coin placed in his mouth to pay for the passage over the river. Sounds much cheaper than the BC ferries we've got here. And they would also have a cake of honey placed in with them to appease the three-headed dog named Cerberus. Cerberus guarded the entrance to Hades. Interment would normally be delayed for 3 days to avoid premature burial. Cremation didn't show up until about 300 BC. And as luck would have it, the Jewish customs were a heck of a lot simpler. Following scripture, they looked at embalming and cremation as mutilation of the body. So instead, they just wrapped their decedents and applied oil and spices. I wonder if these are the same 11 herbs and spices that KFC uses. Then the Romans were also on the same bandwagon with not practicing embalming. They washed their decedents for 7 days straight with hot water and oil. They too had a short delay to avoid premature burial, and they had these groups of slaves called polynctores, P-O-L-L-I-N-C-T-O-R-E-S, and they performed the preservation process. They would hold the funeral processions at night to avoid defilement of the living. The procession was managed by someone called the designator, very much like a modern funeral director today. And over the years, burial gave way to cremations. However, there was a point in time where cremations were forbidden within the gates of Rome, simply because there were too many people being cremated at once, and this would cause smoke pollution. I guess they didn't have air care. The early Christians adopted the burial customs from the Greeks, Jews, and the Romans. They followed the major Jewish tradition of burial with no embalming in respect to the sacred status of the burial grounds. Embalming was generally not practiced during the Dark Ages in Europe. There were great advances made in medicine during this time period, and bodies were needed for dissection purposes. Through this came many discoveries that would have great influence on modern embalming techniques. Leonardo da Vinci apparently produced hundreds of anatomical plates as a result of him dissecting human bodies. He used arterial injection to preserve his specimens. Dr. Frederick Ruysch, R-U-Y-S-C-H, is considered to be the father of embalming in the late 1600s to early 1700s, and he discovered the first successful system of arterial embalming. Then there was a Dr. William Harvey, who was the person who discovered the circulation of the blood. There was another Dr. William Hunter, and this person was credited for being the first to successfully adopt arterial injection as a means of preservation. And then there was a Jean Ganal, G-A-N-N-A-L, and he began as an apothecary's assistant and became the first person to offer embalming to the French public. So for those of you who don't know what an apothecary is, and this was new for me too, an apothecary is a person who prepares and sells medication, kind of like a pharmacist today. This is according to Google. Bacteria was discovered in 1683, and it was discovered when the microscope was being manufactured, and it was being manufactured by this guy by the name of Anthony van Leeuwenhoek. V-A-N-L-E-E-U-W-E-N-H-O-E-K. That's a mouthful. These two gentlemen by the name of Alexander Butlerov and Wilhelm Hoffmann, which I imagine must be still well preserved to this day, were said to have discovered formaldehyde. Dr. Thomas Holmes is also considered to be the father of embalming, but in a more recent times, like the late 1800s to early 1900s. While working as a coroner's assistant, he experimented with preservation chemicals and would later offer his services to the public. And by the turn of the century, wooden coffins and caskets began to appear from the local carpenters and cabinet makers. In previous years, making coffins was actually frowned upon. The cabinet makers rarely made coffins themselves. They really didn't want anything to do with the funeral business. Even the conveyance of the deceased was carried out by someone else, a person called a livery man. So these livery men, over time, would become more involved with providing other funeral services, such as planning the actual funeral. They were essentially the first funeral directors. So these livery men, or funeral directors, would quote-unquote undertake or manage the funeral arrangements and provide all of the paraphernalia needed for the service. So obviously that's where the undertaker terminology came from. So I guess it took a while for the undertaker to be able to be allowed to embalm people. So until then, there was always a rush to bury the decedents. So once the undertaker could do the embalmings as well as everything else encompassed in the funeral, the funeral arrangements could be conducted with much less haste or time sensitivity. And apparently the preliminary embalming fluids were actually arsenic-based, and it didn't take long for the formaldehyde-based solutions to appear, and these are what's still used to this day. Embalming fluid companies would send their reps to travel across the country, presenting a 1 or 2 day course. The course was obviously designed to teach them how to use their chemical product. And after the undertaker had completed the course and, of course, bought a certain quantity of their product, they were then certified to be an embalmer. So you bought something and you were called an embalmer. That's awesome. So this went on till about the 1930s, and then state and provincial licensing came into play. It might seem like the education needed at the time to become an embalmer was a little bit on the light side, but it's also important to keep in mind or in perspective that the doctors and dentists of the day were not much different either. It was the time spent in the field that educated our medical professionals at the time, and the same could be said for funeral directors and embalmers. So now we're at modern day embalming. This is the part where I'm going to go into a bit of detail as to how the embalming process takes place. I've kept it fairly mellow, but it still might be a little bit gory for some of you. So this would be the time that you would fast forward basically to the end of the podcast. Alrighty, are we ready for those of you that stuck around? So first of all, the funeral home must have signed consent from the family in order to embalm. In British Columbia, there is no law stating that you have to embalm your loved one. Now, if you are waiting for family to come in from out of town, let's say, and the service won't be held for at least a week, maybe two, then of course embalming is highly recommended for obvious reasons. And it's still the notion to this day that to many people, funeral homes are out to gouge people or to take advantage of them and stuff like that. And yes, there have been a lot of horror stories throughout the years, but the true funeral home basically has the best interest of the family and of the decedent in mind. And it is entirely the choice of the family, of course, what they what they do with the decedent. But keep in mind that as a funeral provider, we want to make sure that your experience with the funeral service and everything encompassing it is the best it possibly can be. And there is a lot of closure when it comes to having a viewing and maybe even a proper ceremony if you're religious and that kind of stuff. So this is why we offer these kinds of services, because we know it has a healing effect. And I mean, think about it. How do you want to remember your mother or your father? Would you like to remember them looking at peace with, you know, a nicely formed face with light cosmetics and looking as natural as possible? Or would you rather remember them with their eyes wide open and their mouth gaping open and not bathed? And you get my drift. So we offer these services because we want to make sure that your experience is going to be the best it possibly can. It's for the people's health, not necessarily to line our pockets. And we've had a few families in the past that wanted nothing to do with mom or dad. And what I just described to you with the open mouth and eyes was exactly how they viewed them in the casket that they chose, which is basically a cardboard box. So obviously there wasn't much dignity in that. That's strictly my opinion. So anyway, after the funeral home has proper permission to embalm, the decedent is taken out of the body bag and placed on the embalming table. Their private parts are covered with a towel for dignity, obviously, and the bathing process starts. So the hair is washed and the body bathed in soap and warm water. The limbs might be massaged a bit to alleviate the end of rigor mortis. There is a misconception that rigor mortis stays in the body forever, and it doesn't. So rigor mortis comes into play, I believe it's 8 to 12 hours after death, and rigor mortis basically lasts about 12 hours and then goes away, and then the decedent becomes limp again. So while the bathing process is taking place, the embalmer will gauge the condition of the decedent and put together a concoction of the embalming fluids. So there's a ton of different embalming fluids out there nowadays, and there's so much science to it, it's incredible. So there'll be embalming fluids that put moisture into the body if they're emaciated. There'll be embalming fluids that take moisture out of the body if they're bloated or whatnot. There's chemicals that will help with jaundice as well, and chemicals that will either harden the water, soften the water. There's also chemicals that will help bring the color back to the skin. So there's so much to it when you are doing an embalming session that, like I said, you have to gauge the body and basically try to mix the right concoction. And it's really not that hard, but you just need to obviously know what you're looking for. So the embalmer will look at the decedent, assess what chemicals are needed, and then basically create the mixture in the embalming machine. So then a small incision is going to be made on the neck so we can access the common carotid artery and the jugular vein. And there's a hose that comes from the embalming machine with a metal end to it that's called the cannula. And the cannula is going to be placed in the artery, with a small incision, of course, in the artery. And the machine is going to start pumping that chemical into the decedent. The machine itself has even got a pulse action to it to mimic what the heart would do. They say that it pumps the fluid better that way. And we would also make a small incision in the jugular vein at that time. So as the fluid pumps into the artery, it's also pushing the bloods and other fluids out of the vein. So that's basically how we get circulation of the chemicals throughout the body. That's arterial embalming. So while the embalming fluid is being injected into the body, this is also another time where we would massage the limbs to help the circulation get through the rest of the body. Now, there's some times where the decedent is in pretty rough shape with clogged arteries and whatnot. And so in that case, there might be multiple incisions that have to be done. Some maybe at the wrists, some on the thighs, or maybe even lower towards the feet to make sure that we get proper circulation and that everything is basically preserved and disinfected. And this is also basically the time where the features are going to be set on the face. So the eyes would be closed with eye caps, and the mouth would, they call it a mandibular suture, which we use a string, and basically the mouth is tied shut and the lips are put together nice and properly and stuff like that. And we want to get that done ahead of time, because as this fluid takes place in the body, it does its job of preservation and disinfecting, and it hardens up the flesh. So we want to make sure that those features are set and in place before things harden up and make it that much harder to do. So once the arterial embalming is done, now the body cavity has to be disinfected and sanitized or preserved as well. So there's a tool called a trocar, and this is basically a 2-foot hollow rod with a pointed end at one end, and there's a nipple, if you will, at the other end. And the sinks in the prep rooms or the embalming rooms have got what's called an aspirator attached to it. It's basically like a suction type of machine. So a hose would be connected to the end of this trocar. The trocar would be inserted into the stomach and basically just be poked around, which would perforate all the organs while sucking out all of the body fluids at the same time. Once this step is finished, the trocar is used once again, but this time at the end of that hose is going to be a bottle of cavity fluid, which is basically embalming fluid. And so now this fluid is inserted into the body cavity, and that's what's going to help preserve and sanitize that area of the body. So once that procedure is done, any of the finishing touches are done. The incisions are now sewn up and sealed. The body is dried and eventually it's dressed. Then the decedent will be placed in the casket and properly positioned. You wouldn't maybe think of it, but the decedent, once they're placed in that casket, they actually need to be positioned somewhat to look as comfortable as possible and as natural as possible. And the finishing touches to the hair and makeup will be done at that time. Now the decedent is ready to view. The entire embalming process normally takes about 60 to 90 minutes. It really depends on the state of the decedent when we start. The embalming fluids are extremely potent, pretty much carcinogenic, I would say. And they can easily irritate the eyes and throat in just a few seconds after a bottle being dropped. The embalming room is mandated to have a proper ventilation system that must circulate the air so many times per hour to keep our embalmers safe. Now, depending on the exterior conditions, an embalmed decedent could stay preserved for quite some time if the embalming process was done properly and the proper time taken to do it right. So this, guys, will basically conclude the episode of the history of things, the history of embalming. If you made it this far, thank you so much for hanging around. And if you're new to the podcast, welcome, and I hope I was able to entertain you somewhat. And if you're a return customer, thank you again for returning. And if you've enjoyed this, please give me a 5-star rating. It helps with the algorithms and helps get my podcast name out there. And yeah, tell your friends, tell your family, share it with others. And any support at all that you can do for the podcast is greatly, greatly appreciated. So once again, thank you all for everything, and we'll see you on the next episode. Take care.